Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The next oral case on our calendar today is A21-0953, Jenny Pachicano versus Julie Ward. I hope I pronounced appellant's name correctly. If not, you can correct me in a moment, Mr. Bird. The oral argument today is proceeding by Zoom. Each party will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a timer that you can see in the grid view. Hopefully you're able to see that now. If there's any issues with the timer, we'll stop the oral argument and take care of that, but it should be just fine. We are recording this oral argument. Just a reminder that no other recordings of the oral argument are permitted except with the express prior permission of the Court of Appeals. The oral argument, our recording will be posted to our website in the near future. So I'll just ask the counsel, please identify yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument. And counsel for appellant, you can proceed when you're ready. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. My name is Charlie Bird from Rochester, Minnesota, and I'm representing the appellant in this case. And may it please the court and Ms. Sorensen. The question for this court is whether a jury could conclude, when all reasonable inferences from the facts are drawn in favor of the appellant, was it objectively foreseeable that the appellant would encounter this open and obvious danger and potentially be injured? That's the question here. We're on summary judgment, appeal from summary judgment. Your standard of review is de novo. The Supreme Court, as you, I think we all as members of the bar have recognized, Supreme Court in recent years has kind of gone out of its way to make clear to everybody that they're going to really strictly apply rules that maybe were relaxed in the past. And among these, of course, are some recent decisions that I've cited, like Montemayor, the more recent Staub decision, where the person was dead and nobody even could testify, you know, live testimony about why there was a fall. And then, of course, more importantly to this case is the Sinoglis decision. And it's under those rules that we're evaluating this case. And we're far from the time, I think, that might have applied maybe 10 years ago where appellate courts were maybe, giving some deference to a trial court and trying to find facts in support. You can't do that. And what we have here is a situation where these stairs are dangerous, and some might say ridiculously dangerous if you were to look at the steepness of them, the narrowness of the tread, the fact that the defendant had fallen twice, the plaintiff had fallen once, not injured herself because it was towards the bottom of the stairs, and they had set up this Christmas wrapping station in the basement, which was the invitation and the certain knowledge that people were going to encounter that danger in order to go down the steps and try to wrap the presents and therefore encounter the danger, which is the exception to the exception of the rule that has been laid out for many years.
And counsel, in considering the exception to the exception, is it proper to consider plaintiff's familiarity with the stairs based on prior use?
I don't think so. No, it is not. It's an objective standard, and you don't, as the court indicated, and it's one of these cases I got in front of me, and I think it is the Sinoglis case, I believe, but they basically said no. The specific facts and circumstances of a case are, while they're important, we still are based on an objective standard. Now, what's in the, and I think the thing is that it's a it's viewed not from the standpoint of the victim, but instead of the person. In this case, it's the respondent, and that is what does she know or reasonably objectively know that would put her in a position of telling herself people are going to go down these stairs, even though they are really dangerous. And so I got to fix them. I got to do something. I got to put some lights there. I got to do whatever. And the issue isn't one that we're saying can't be argued to a jury. It's just whether or not we get by summary judgment at this point and can argue our case to a jury. And I think what
the trial court, on that point, Mr. Bird, what would you argue to the jury? I'd like to know. And here it's like, as you say, what facts would you argue to the jury that the exception applies because Ward should have anticipated the harm to your client?
Well, I would say, and we're talking about an objective standard.
I got it.
The plaintiff had herself fallen once. It was a third step from the bottom, didn't get injured. The stairs were extremely steep. The treads were very narrow. The top tread on which she slipped was slippery. The handrail was low, and it was on the right side, and you had to bend over while making that first step in order to engage the railing, which would be one of the safety features, and do that while you are balancing a bag of Christmas gifts in the other arm. And that defendant, or actually respondent here, had herself fallen twice. And so the issue here is, are we going to say, well, we're going to engage in some kind of roulette, and we're going to just allow people to encounter it. And if they've gone down it before, we're going to establish a rule here that there's no risk to them in going down again. And that's my argument to the jury. This thing had to get fixed. It should have been fixed. It should have been dealt with. Lighting could have been handled. I mean, that's my argument to the jury. And
what if the facts were this? Would the exception still apply if they had not set up the Christmas wrapping presents, you know, protocol in the basement? What if your client just went down knowing all that she knew, she just decided to go down to the basement anyway? Would that make a difference in terms of the exception applying?
Well, of course, that's not the case, but nonetheless, one of the things to consider here, Your Honor, is that they had a bedroom set up down there. The washer and dryer was down there. People were going down those stairs all the time. It was not an unused part of the home. It was considered an integral part. And just going down there for no reason or at all. But on the other hand, if let's say somebody was staying there that was her brother or something for Christmas, and say, well, come on down and let's talk about something. I mean, you know, I don't know what those other circumstances might have been, but I don't know that anybody in there, and it might be important, if there was no purpose whatsoever in trying to traverse those steps. I don't know if that answers your question.
Let me ask this.
Yes, thank you.
If there was just a ladder going down there, say a rickety old ladder, and the plaintiff went down anyway, would that change the analysis?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, if they're saying, in order to go from point A to point B, you are going to encounter this known danger, then the question is it a fact question for a jury? And I think it remains a fact question for a jury, depending on what the circumstances were for the plaintiff encountering that danger. Now, this isn't a rickety old ladder. And so
well, the question I'm asking is, at what point does the plaintiff or the injured person accept the risk of going down the stairs?
Well, I think, and first of all, let me answer with respect to this case. It's clearly with it, it's a fact question in this case. And are there situations where you would say you're crazy to even encounter it, even though they set up the Christmas wrapping station in the basement? And I think you could posit a hypothetical that liability would be denied. So,
I guess that's my question is, how extreme does that have to be, in your opinion? How extreme does the risk have to be?
I don't know. I hadn't thought about that. I think that the risk has to be one that I think it would be a rarer situation. And I don't know if you're asking me to a risk of falling of 50% or more in a given hypothetical. I just don't know really how to go about answering that.
Mr. And I don't think this is that case.
Thank you.
Does it depend on whether the advantages of going down the stairs would outweigh the risks to in analyzing whether the exception to the exception applies?
Well, I think that is some language that the courts have used in the past, but Your Honor, if you go to the Sinoglis case, you know, you talk about the advantages and disadvantages of that child, you know, going into the river in that particular situation, and it's hard to analyze that case, you know, using an advantage and disadvantage, analysis.
Isn't that a different case because that is a child as opposed to someone who is encountering a known risk?
That is a child. And I think the court did emphasize in Sinoglis that because it was a child, we treat it somewhat differently. Now, going back to your...
I assume in that case, Mr. Bird, in Sinoglis, I mean, the child had not fallen into the river once before, right?
He had not fallen into the river once before. No, he hadn't fallen once before. But again, it's an objective standard. It's not, and the judge here in this case, engaged in weighing the evidence, and that's on page 5 of that memo where she's making these statements. She had never suffered any injury in the past from her repeated usage of the stairs. That's a subjective comment. And that there was nothing to make her feel rushed to get to the basement or distracted. Again, that's a subjective analysis based upon the viewpoint of the victim here. And the plaintiff's past experience successfully traversing the steep staircase, and she, of course, had not successfully traversed it. It's just that she didn't get injured when she fell. To go back to your point, advantage versus disadvantage, I think there is an advantage here, Judge Cochran, that scene, we're going to go down and wrap these presents in the basement, everything's set up for you down there. And so she starts down the stairs. And the fact of the matter is, she is encountering a risk of getting injured. But she had only fallen that one time. And the question is, from the standpoint of the respondent, was it something that was reasonably anticipated that there's going to be risk of injury objectively in this particular situation? And we have a fact question for a jury here using that standard. Okay, I think I'm done, unless you have any further questions.
I don't see any further questions. Thank you. Counsel for respondent, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, Your Honors, Mr. Bird. My name is Stacey Sorensen of the Law Offices of John Severson, and I represent the respondent in this case, Julie Ward. Your Honors, the appellant's case is like a game of Jenga. Her counsel have precariously stacked several facts that they hope will convince you amount to a solid structure that create a question of fact regarding the foreseeability of the appellant's injury in this case. But in reality, the pieces do not fit together. And if you remove just one piece, their entire case falls apart. And Your Honors, I must begin my argument today by removing one of the pieces in their case, because it's a fact not found anywhere in the record and is simply not true. And that fact is that on December 25th of 2015, there was a wrapping station set up in the basement of my client's home. If you look back at the record you've been provided, Your Honors, specifically document 33, which is the plaintiff's deposition transcript, the plaintiff testifies that when she arrives at my client's home, she encounters another sister named Carrie Ward. Keep in mind that the appellant and the respondent are both sisters, and they have another sister named Carrie Ward. And when the appellant arrived at my client's home, she said that she had some gifts to wrap, and Carrie Ward said, "I've got some wrapping paper in the basement." Now, telling someone that there's wrapping paper in the basement is an entirely different thing than a formal wrapping station being set up where people are specifically directed to wrap presents. And if you remove that fact from the case, it all falls apart. And Your Honors, you picked up on that with your questioning. The appellant wants that fact in the case. She wants that to be true because it more aligns the case with the previous precedent set in Peterson versus W.T. Raleigh Company. If you'll recall, in that case, the plaintiff had to cross an icy parking lot to get to his employer's building so he could conduct his work. And he had to make the choice whether, you know, it's worth risking the icy conditions and potentially falling or losing his employment. And the Minnesota Supreme Court held that when a person is faced with that choice, the employer or the landowner is not relieved of their duty because they know that they have to encounter this dangerous situation or risk something particularly significant to their lives. And I submit to you that some wrapping paper being located in a basement that the appellant could use or could not use is not sufficiently compelling to be analogous to Peterson based on the holding in that case. So when you remove
in appellant's brief, they also reference that appellant was told that to wrap presents in the basement so that the children would not see the gifts before they were opened. Are you disputing that reference in the record?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. The appellant testified that it was her preference to not have the children see the presents she bought, but no one directed her that she must wrap presents in the basement so that the children don't see them. That's simply not a fact on the record.
Was there any place other than the basement where the appellant could have wrapped presents? You know, I mean, my impression of this was a small house. And was there some other place she could have wrapped these presents, you know, outside of the presence of the children?
Yes. The evidence on the record is that the family members were gathered in the living room of the house, and there was a bedroom on the main level of the house that there's no evidence it was being occupied or used for any particular reason. So there was a room available. And certainly the appellant could have asked my client to go downstairs and get the wrapping paper if she, you know, had wanted to do that, but she didn't. She made the conscious choice to go do that. And that's where the cases of Baber versus Dill and Sutherland versus Barton are particularly important in this case, because both of those cases tell us that we care about a person's knowledge of this potentially dangerous condition. We care what their experience is, what their training is, and how they have interacted with this condition in the past. And when you look at the facts in this case, both the appellant and the respondent had the exact same knowledge about the staircase. Both of them moved into the house when their parents purchased the home in 1989. Both of them lived in the house off and on several occasions throughout their lives. Both of them had used those stairs countless number of times, whether they were living in the house or visiting the house. Both of them knew of the steepness of the stairs. Both of them knew of the depth of the tread. Both of them knew the location of the handrail. And both of them knew that this stairway had not been altered in any substantial way since their parents purchased the home in 1989. And similarly, both had fallen on the stairs before, the appellant once and my client twice, without any injury. Now, that's three times in likely thousands of times over the years that this home was owned by this family. And so, and I,
well, given that it's an objective standard and given the knowledge that people had fallen before, why isn't there at least a fact dispute as to the exception to the exception?
There's no fact dispute because the question really is, does my client, the respondent, have superior knowledge over the appellant regarding the condition of the stairs, that she knows that the appellant could be seriously injured where the appellant doesn't? That fact does not exist. You cannot create a fact question out of speculation. The facts are that they had the exact same knowledge of this condition. So that why then is respondent's knowledge somehow supposed to be superior? Counsel was asked, whether or not the case law requires us to look at the appellant's knowledge or the person who was injured, their knowledge of the condition. He said no, and that simply is not true. And the case law that he's focusing on, Senegalese, actually says that we do care about that person's knowledge. In that case, it was a four-year-old child. And the reason there was a question of fact is because the court did not know what that four-year-old child knew about the dangers associated with going in the river. Whereas we know 100% on the record, it is absolutely clear that we know that the appellant knew the dangers that she was encountering, and she made the choice to encounter them anyways.
Ms. Sorensen, I'm trying to, you make a very compelling case, but I have to say the law seems to be shifting in Mr. Bird's direction. So what I'm trying to get a handle on is, the exception to the exception, unless Ward should have anticipated the harm to Pachian, hope I pronounced that right, to Pachicano. So they both know, because they've both fallen with injuries, without injuries, that, these stairs are pretty dreadful. So, okay, so they both know that the stairs are an open and obvious dangerous. So would your client be liable if she knew that no matter what, Mr. Bird's client just loves to go down to the basement, and even though she knows it's dangerous, she's got some, this is an extreme example, some sort of compulsion that she goes down anyway because she just goes down there. I mean, is that the sort of thing we're looking for? Some sort of children are attracted to water. I think that was the thing that the Supreme Court was sort of talking about. So yeah, even though it's obvious, children always go to water. Well, maybe if your client always knew that Mr. Bird's client just has this, maybe compulsion is the wrong word, but she always goes down there. It's sort of you don't know what's good for you. I mean, we should be looking for in terms of your client anticipating the harm? I mean, what should we be looking for that exception to apply, Ms. Sorensen?
I think there could be fact scenarios where a person is compelled to repeatedly encounter a dangerous condition. And that would certainly be relevant to the analysis, because if you know that every single time she comes in the house, immediately she goes into the basement, I think that could change the facts. But that's not the facts that we have before us. We have the fact that this person, fully aware of the condition, made the choice to go down there for a not particularly compelling reason. And I would submit to you that the case law set forth by the court in both Baber as well as Sutherland, both of those cases are actually an exception to the exception to the exception, if that makes any sense. I mean, they're saying that a landowner doesn't have a duty if a condition is open and obvious, unless they know the person is likely to encounter it anyways, except if the person encountering the condition has specific extensive knowledge and understanding of that condition. And that's what we have in this case. In Sutherland, it was an electrician who had knowledge and training regarding the dangers of electrical wires. And no, she was not an employee of, you know, she was not working. She wasn't trained through education, but the plaintiff and appellant fully admits that she knew about all the risks associated with those stairs. She knew all the details regarding the components of those stairs. And I think it's important too that the appellant was very concerned when her family lived in the house and her 11-year-old son lived there. She was concerned about her son using the stairs, but she let him use them anyways. This was her choice. And to erase her knowledge of the stairs, like counsel wants you to do, he doesn't want you to consider her knowledge at all. He only wants you to focus on my client's knowledge, which was identical, that essentially will create a scenario that will invite homeowners throughout the state who undoubtedly have houses built in 1935, like this house, with stairways or other structural conditions unique to that era that are considered grandfathered in to our building code laws, because we know that it's cost prohibitive to try and restructure some of these things. So we're left with a situation where all we can do is educate people about these conditions. And that's what my client did, essentially. She knew that her sister had familiarity with the stairs, and she knew that her sister knew the risks she was taking, and her sister made that choice. And I don't think there's anything in any of the case law cited by counsel that contradicts this. I do want to point out that counsel cited to a case, a very recent case. It's not currently published. It's so recent, the Staub versus Myrtle Lake Resort case. And I just want to point out that the issue before the court was not foreseeability or duty. The question in that case is whether circumstantial evidence could be used as a way to decide whether or not there's foreseeability, because in that case, there were no eyewitnesses to the plaintiff's fall and the plaintiff had died as a result. So there was no evidence as to what specifically caused the fall. So the concern in that case was whether they could use all this other circumstantial evidence in order to allow a jury to reach that conclusion. So I submit to you that case is irrelevant to the case at hand, because it's an entirely different issue that needs to be decided.
Would it make a difference if the homeowner had put up a big sign and said, danger, caution going downstairs?
If it were anyone other than the appellant, I think it would. But that sign would not have provided any new or additional information that the appellant didn't already know when she went down those stairs that day. And so for all of these reasons, I ask that you affirm the district court's granting of summary judgment in this case, because there is not sufficient evidence to show that there should have been a duty in this case, and there's not a question of fact. Thank you.
Counsel, hypothetically, if someone who had never been to the home before stopped by to visit and they decided to go down the stairs to get some wrapping paper and they fell and hurt themselves. In that case, would there be a fact question for the jury on the exception to the exception?
In that case, I believe there would. And I see that I'm just about out of time. Can I finish my thought?
Certainly.
Okay. So yes, if the person had no prior knowledge of the stairs, then they should be warned. Our law tells us they should be warned, but that's not the case here, because the appellant had the knowledge that new entrant wouldn't have had.
Thank you. Any further questions for respondent? All right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Byrd, you can proceed with rebuttal when you're ready.
All right. Hey, thank you. So what we just heard was a weighing of the evidence analysis. The argument that, well, we didn't have a wrapping station, we had wrapping paper down there, and whether or not it's reasonable in this particular situation to draw an inference that that's where they had the wrapping set up, that's weighing the evidence, and that's what is impermissible here. And that's what gets this to the jury, and that she can make all of those arguments to the fact finder.
I don't know. I mean, either Carrie Ward said there's wrapping paper in the basement or she didn't. Do you dispute that it was Carrie Ward who said there's wrapping paper in the basement?
That is what Carrie Ward said. There's wrapping paper in the basement, and whether she went
nothing,
down there.
And Ms. Sorensen didn't. Ms. Sorensen's client didn't say that.
No, but Ms. Sorensen's client was in the house at the time that comment was made. And I think the evidence was that she was in the kitchen, which is right next to where the stairway was.
So she should have said, yeah, but you know, the stairs rickety, don't go down there.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying they should have fixed the stairs so that when people encountered a known danger to go down and get wrapping paper or wrap presents, however you want to, claim what the reasonable inferences are.
I think you would have a stronger argument for the exception to the exception if Ward knew that, you know, there was some picture of grandma in the basement and your client always goes to see that picture in the basement because, you know, she loved her grandmother and she just is always going to go down in the basement. And so at that point, then Ms. Sorensen's client is on notice. You know, I really, you know, even though she knows she shouldn't go down there, she's always going to go down there because she always has a specific purpose to see the picture of grandmother. So I really need to fix the stairs. But I'm not so sure that the scenario of, you know, well, there's wrapping paper in the basement is enough to indicate that she should have anticipated the harm. So why am I wrong, Mr. Byrd?
Well, I mean, it's your very statement that you're not so sure. I mean, and so those not so sure statements are things that go to the jury. And all I'm saying, Your Honor, is that if you were the finder of fact, it's pretty plain how you'd rule on this, but you are not. You are viewing this de novo.
Well, actually, I wouldn't want to be the finder of fact. I would have just assumed that you would, Ms. Sorensen would have settled the case before it ever got to me. So there you go.
Okay. Well, but Your Honor, let me, I think I've made that point, and I want to go on to Sutherland. Sutherland is a case where they hired the electrical contractor. I only have a couple minutes left, and so I want to get to this. But the holding in Sutherland is at, it's on the last page of the decision where they're saying that Sutherland had expertise as an electrician. The defendant in that case had hired the electrical company to do this dangerous work because theoretically they were going to take all the safety precautions necessary. And this guy, you know, used an electrical tape that he was waving around that was metal and contacted a bus bar. And it's in that very specific situation where you're hiring a contractor to do the dangerous work that they're saying there's no liability. And the same thing with Baber versus Dill. I mean, if you look at Baber, and that's 531 Northwest 2nd at 496, the specific holding of the Supreme Court is, in the present case, we conclude a landowner has no duty to an invitee to warn or make safe known or obvious conditions when that invitee has assisted in creating those conditions. That's not this case. And Sutherland isn't this case. These two cases, which are the two cases the trial court relied upon, simply are no authority supporting the situation. And all we're saying is, if we get what we're entitled to, those reasonable inferences, all reasonable inferences, everything has to be looked at our way on summary judgment. Do we get to a jury where Ms. Sorensen can make her arguments and we can make ours? And I think we do. And so I guess I'll conclude it at that. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments. The matter is now submitted.